Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, Assistant Professor in Small Animal Orthopaedics at Michigan State University, Karen Perry. Thank you, Karen. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. So we're going to talk a little bit today about minimally invasive osteosynthesis. It's a little earlier in the day here, so I hope I'll still be able to pronounce that for you by the end. First things first, I just want to acknowledge my mentor in minimally invasive surgery, who is Dr. Loic Desjardins. He is the originator of several new minimally invasive techniques, and some of the images that I have used in this presentation do appear courtesy of him. I think if you're going to take on minimally invasive surgery as a new thing that you haven't really done a lot of before, it is important to have someone who has a bit more experience to give you a hand, whether they are remotely or on site. And certainly it's helped me traverse the learning curve quicker than I would have been able to do otherwise, I think. So if we look at the evolution of modern osteosynthesis and how we've got to where we are here, I think in an effort to improve on the poor functional outcomes that were originally associated with external skeletal fixation or external coaptation and or long-term patient immobilization, starting in the late 1950s, open reduction and internal fixation did become the modus operandi recommended by the AO Foundation and others for the treatment of long bone fractures. Although strict adhesion to the open reduction internal fixation principles of anatomic reduction, rigid fixation allowed the restoration of absolute mechanical stability, it came with a hefty biologic price inherent to the extensive iatrogenic surgical trauma, including disturbance of the fracture hematoma, inevitable damage to the local soft tissues, and unfortunately the blood supply as well. And as a result, despite the improved outcomes that were compared with earlier techniques, open reduction internal fixation was also accompanied by the rise of new complications such as delayed or non-union, implant failure, and osteomyelitis. And these observations led to the reiteration of the early AO principles of preservation of blood supply, gentle soft tissue handling, and early immobilization. And in practical terms, this did lead to a biologically friendlier open but do not touch approach, which focused on achieving alignment of the bone rather than strict anatomic reduction, and focused on optimal rather than rigid stability, minimal use of hardware as well. Nonetheless, open but do not touch techniques do still favour manipulation of the bone fragments, albeit remotely, and they did continue to put an emphasis on the mechanical rigidity of the repaired bone, as illustrated by that extensive use of the plate rod combination that we still see in the treatment of comminuted fractures. So despite the fact we were preserving the soft tissue and blood supply and allowing that early mobilisation, we still didn't resolve all of our issues. The difference between these two fractures here that you can see, if you look at these very carefully, in terms of the diaphyseal component of the fracture, these do look fairly similar. The main difference here, probably based on these views at least, is it looks like the fibula on one side is intact, whereas in the other fracture, the fibula has been fractured. And we'll come back to these two fractures in a second, but looking at these now, you might think that you have several options to treat these, minimally invasive surgery potentially being one of them. Now, during the past two decades, the ongoing review of clinical outcomes by the AO Foundation and others has led to a radical paradigm shift towards further emphasizing the biological component of fracture healing. And this has become the foundation of this new philosophic approach known as minimally invasive osteosynthesis. Now, with MIO, the fracture site is not exposed, which in turn preserves the fracture hematoma and promotes earlier fracture healing. Rather, indirect reduction techniques, which we'll go through later, through gentle manipulation of the main bone fragments and small approaches that are remote to the fracture site are used to introduce the implant in an epiperiosteal fashion, if we're talking about a plate, or an intramedullary fashion, if we're talking about a nail. In addition, we've kind of abandoned really the use of intrafragmentary screws, cerclage wires, bone grafts, and anatomic reduction. And these have really become the hallmarks of this minimally invasive osteosynthesis technique. And this evolution does favour the preservation of a biologic environment essential to bone healing. From a mechanical perspective, emphasis is put on achieving optimal construct stability rather than that rigid interfragmentary stability. And this is accomplished by several iterations of more traditional osteosynthesis techniques, such as increased reliance on longer, more compliant bridging implants that tend to bypass the fracture site altogether. Now, certainly MIO is not the absolute goal if joint incongruity, malalignment, or instability is going to be your price to pay. And again, we'll go back to these two fractures here. Now, if you do have intra-articular fractures, we're certainly going to look at those a little later in the presentation, but all of our principles of intra-articular fracture repair still hold true, even if we decide to repair them using minimally invasive techniques. So they must still be anatomically reduced and stabilized using rigid fixation and interfragmentary compression where possible. And I'll take you through a case where we didn't achieve that, and we certainly did pay the price for that later on. So again, going back to these two fractures here, you can see that one has a very, very long approach there. We've used cerclage wires, and the other looks like we've had a minimally invasive approach. So you may presume, looking at these two radiographs, that the fracture on the right, as we're looking at the screens here, has been produced, repaired in a less invasive fashion and may go on to heal more quickly. However, what we need to remember is that surgical soft tissue damage is not seen on postoperative radiographs. And I can tell you that the fracture on the left was repaired by a very meticulous surgeon. Certainly, there was very minimal soft tissue damage despite the open approach. The other fracture, although it looks like there wouldn't have been much soft tissue damage, was repaired by a surgeon who was very new to MIO and unfortunately persisted with MIO for several hours in order to achieve this result. So probably actually caused more soft tissue damage than the other fracture. So we really need to be aware that certainly we cannot appreciate on a radiograph how much damage we've caused. And it is important, I think, to give yourself maybe a time limit to say, if I'm not making progress with minimally invasive surgery, I'm going to convert to the open approach that I'm more familiar with, and maybe give yourself a time zone of 15 to 20 minutes to be making progress and then move on from there. It is the iatrogenic damage to the soft tissues rather than the incision length which is going to affect healing time and functional recovery. So therefore, if you cannot achieve limb alignment completely closed or with the help of small incisions, one option is to make a third portal, so an observation portal if you like, so that you can view the fracture zone but not manipulate it and still maintain a largely minimally invasive approach. If alignment still cannot be achieved, then again, we need to consider that converting to an open but do not touch technique with a long incision over the length of the bone, but without manipulation of the fracture fragments. And this more generous approach can certainly facilitate indirect reduction of the fracture where necessary. So we've talked about preserving the fracture hematoma, but why do we really want to do that? In a study by Grundness and others in 1993, bilateral femoral fractures were produced in three different groups of rats. The fracture hematoma was removed on one side after 30 minutes, 2 days, and 4 days in the other two groups, respectively. The fractures were mechanically tested at 4 weeks. And when the fracture hematoma was removed early, callus formation, bending moment, and fracture energy were all decreased. Removal of the hematoma at day 2 or 4 impaired fracture healing even more, as bending moment, bending rigidity, and fracture energy were greatly decreased compared to the control fractures. And it was concluded that the fracture hematoma does favour healing, and that removal of the hematoma after a few days is more harmful to healing than if the hematoma is removed in that initial phase. So you can see this might start to become important when we're thinking about which fractures we really want to treat in a minimally invasive fashion. So we'll go through a few cases. So this is a case here. So this case was a 68 kilogram, 7-year-old male dog, crossbreed dog, and this fracture was 7 days old on presentation. So when we first looked at the radiograph here, you might think, well, just looking at the radiograph, this looks quite tempting to try and do minimally invasively. It's not really that displaced. You've got a nice bone fragment proximally and distally that you can manipulate without getting anywhere near the fracture site, so it might become quite tempting. However, in this case, indirect reduction was going to be really difficult to achieve. The dog was very big, it was very well muscled, and certainly attempts to do so in this case were thought more likely to cause more soft tissue damage than an open approach. So in this case, we did elect to do an open but do not touch approach. still with minimal manipulation at the fracture site. And you can see that the fracture callus has still been maintained. We've left all that kind of jelly-like material there at the fracture site, even though it's very tempting always to try and suction that out and make it look nice and clean. And you can see here we've achieved a fairly good result. The vessels have all been maintained over the fracture site. Here is our post-op x-ray. You can see certainly not a minimally invasive approach by the number of staples there. But if we then look at a radiograph at 8 weeks postoperatively, healing is progressing as we would expect in that seven-year-old dog with that type of fracture. So certainly, I think decision-making in these cases can be super important. And in this case, I wouldn't be keen to try and do this one minimally invasively. So even with a really large open approach, we can still be biologically friendly with this open but do not touch technique. And this approach still implies that preservation of blood supply and gentle soft tissue handling in an attempt to reduce those complications that we've seen, those delayed unions and non-unions, implant failures and osteomyelitis. Now, this has clearly not been the approach that's been taken in the figure on the right here. Here, the bone fragments have been completely cleared of all of the soft tissue. The fascial planes and muscle bodies don't look like they've been particularly respected in the approach. And I suspect this is a case of rather over-exuberant suction. When I see those very, very white bone fragments, that tends to indicate someone's been a little bit keen with their suction tip. And certainly you'd be worried about the blood supply and the soft tissue extraosseous blood supply here for this particular case. So certainly we're not really wanting to see that kind of appearance, much more keen to see the appearance that you can see in that picture on the left-hand side. So here's another case here, and this was a really interesting one for me. So this is a 25-kilogram dog. It was a pit bull terrier, 4 years old, female, and the fracture was 3 days old when she came to see us. And I think when you look at this fracture, you kind of think, would I want to approach this with a minimally invasive technique or not? And certainly when I first saw this, I thought this would be a great one to do minimally invasively. The fracture is 3 days old. I can't reduce this anyway. It's severely comminuted. The best I can hope for is aligning the joints above and below. And then I can maintain that fracture hematoma, which is 3 days old, and that's going to be beneficial for my fracture healing. However, when I look here a little bit more carefully at this fracture, you can see here that it looks like there's a bone fragment that's sitting within the medullary canal distally. And certainly this is going to be important if I want to treat this minimally invasively. Certainly if I want to use an interlocking nail, which would probably be my preference here, then if I place the nail minimally invasively, it's actually going to meet that fragment, push it further down into the medullary canal, and probably prevent me from placing my nail where I want it to, as well as leaving a fragment there that's going to impair healing. And even if I use a plate, certainly it's going to impair healing still, because I have that big fragment of cortex sitting within the medullary canal there. So I did perform a CT scan to confirm that that's where the fragment was, and you can see for sure there is that fragment sitting right there in the medullary canal. So this is going to be, if you see this is a reason to change your approach, and you do need to use an open approach here and fish that fragment out of the medullary canal before placing stabilization. So unfortunately this was not one I could do minimally invasively, but I thought I'd pass this experience on to you, because certainly in another case I did miss this and struggled to place the nail for quite a long time before realizing why I was having difficulty. So hopefully now you'll look for this and not make the same mistake that I did. But you can see here with an open approach, we did achieve a good technique for this dog. And certainly you can see here progressive healing at 6 weeks post-op there. And then at 9 weeks post-op, she came back just a couple of weeks ago for that final checkup there. So going on to our minimally invasive approaches then. So definitely we're going to need to have our landmarks here. So we need the joints proximal and distal to the fracture in mature patients, or the physis proximal and distal to the fracture in skeletally immature patients. And these can be identified, as you can see in this video and picture here, using 25 gauge needles. So this is an immature dog. We've got needles in the physis here to show our proximal and distal extents. And I start the video here. So for the tibia, the proximal incision is between your cranial and caudal sartorius muscles, and the distal incision is going to be between the tibial caudalis and the flexor digitorum profundus tendons. For the radius, similar incisions are going to be proximally between the extensor carpi radialis and the pronator teres muscles, and distally then between the tendon of the extensor carpi radialis and the tendon of the common digital extensor. So for immature dogs, you can see we've made those incisions just above and below the needles, remote to the fracture site. And that's going to allow us then to make our epiperiosteal tunnel and slide our plate so that it fits between those two needles there. When we think about our approaches for intra-articular fractures, which many of them can be treated via minimally invasive surgery, the size of the approach no longer is the primary consideration here, and the approach should be as large as you feel is necessary so that you can achieve that anatomical reduction reliably and make sure we get a good result for these patients. And this is an example of a condylar fracture here that we did treat minimally invasively. You can see here a selection of images from intraoperatively showing our implant placement with the fluoroscopy. And certainly, I think when we think about minimally invasive surgery for long bone fractures, particularly the radius and the tibia, you can often cope without fluoroscopy. Actually, we're using it less and less frequently, even for the humeral and femoral fractures too. But for articular fractures, I would recommend having intraoperative imaging available. I think it's very, very helpful for those cases. You can see here for this case, as we go through, these are our images here, and then our post-op result here. So you can see we have achieved accurate anatomic alignment and apposition of those fragments. So, as we said, intraoperative imaging is not absolutely necessary, but it can often be helpful. Something to definitely bear in mind, however, is that the use of ionizing radiation does have long-term insidious health effects, and certainly the benefits of this technology do have to be carefully weighed against those potential health hazards. The most obvious limitation to the use of minimally invasive osteosynthesis is that inability to assess the reduction status during surgery because you're not looking directly at that fracture site. And indirectly, this greatly affects the evaluation of alignment and of structural abnormalities of the fractured bone. So, for example, fissure lines, if you haven't appreciated them on your preoperative imaging, then you may not appreciate them in surgery either if we don't have this open surgical approach. So intraoperative fluoroscopy does reduce this relative blindness by providing live feedback on your reduction status, your alignment restoration, and implant positioning. And certainly, as we've mentioned, the necessity of fluoroscopy is going to vary with the segment of bone you're dealing with and the fracture pattern as well. So in lower segments, the radius and the tibia, we do have those readily palpable anatomical landmarks available, and these can be used along with joint range of motion to assess fragment location and orientation. In contrast, the upper segments are more difficult to assess. Obviously, they do have the larger soft tissue envelopes. When they have fractured, they often have very large soft tissue envelopes due to their swelling. And their proximity to the body wall also can make things complicated. So this can make more fluoroscopy more helpful and sometimes necessary in these locations in order to assist with reduction maneuvers and to improve your intraoperative assessment of alignment. But certainly, safety equipment is going to be imperative. You do want to be wearing lead gowns, thyroid shields, individual dosimeters. You're going to want those warning signs of ionizing radiation being in use. And remember, it's also going to be very helpful if you have a radiolucent operating table. Otherwise, certainly for the proximal bone segments, you're going to struggle to get those really nice images. So I think one of the most challenging things with minimally invasive surgery can be that reduction of the fracture. And while we don't want anatomic reduction, that's not our goal with minimally invasive surgery, functional reduction with restoration of bone length and restoration of correct alignment in the frontal, sagittal, and axial planes is going to be something we want to achieve. Now, there are many indirect reduction techniques available to obtain functional fracture reduction without opening the fracture site. And these methods allow the fracture fragments to remain connected to the soft tissues, which is key to improving that bone healing because viable bone rapidly unites by callus formation. So the general principle is going to be the use of the soft tissue envelope to help stabilize and reduce the fracture fragments indirectly. And this can be achieved through forces applied either on the adjacent bone segments or on the epiphyseal and metaphyseal regions of the fractured bones. And this would be the so-called ligamentotaxis. So examples of techniques that have been available, certainly traction tables are available. Limb hanging techniques are probably one of the most simple and one of the most, in my hands, useful. Just hanging the limb before surgery, as you can see in this picture here, can be super helpful. Intramedullary pinning can be useful as well. Temporary applications of linear or circular external fixators or fracture distractors. And also, as you can see in the bottom images there, percutaneous bone holding forceps, they've been applied directly through the skin, can be used as well. Certainly something else that's a nice little tip is, as you can see in this top image here, if we just get the arrow working, here we go. So you can see that we have used some bandages here to pull the limb in different directions and to help reduction. And that can be really helpful and a really kind of low tech technique, if you like. So traction tables are pretty commonly used in human trauma patients, and recently a skeletal traction table was specifically designed for veterinary traumatology. The table allows intraoperative skeletal traction to be applied in small animals with safe application of opposition and anchorage points. Now the opposition points are defined as points on the body where stabilization can be applied to counteract the traction forces and avoid translation without injuring the patient. While anchorage points are defined as the points where traction can be applied distal to the fractured skeletal segment without damaging the bone or the soft tissues. And it is mandatory to follow the suggested steps in applying the technique, as it is pretty powerful and it can potentially be dangerous if it's applied incorrectly. Suspending the limb from the ceiling, as we spoke about already, orientates the limb in a vertical position. By lowering the surgical table, then the animal's own weight can distract the fracture and help align the joint surfaces. Intraoperative imaging is also greatly facilitated by this technique, as both the frontal and sagittal planes will be unobstructed, and the C-arm can then be freely moved around your patient. You do need to be aware that this technique does not provide control over the horizontal plane, so you still need to be making sure that you maintain that rotational alignment as well. In tibial fractures, it's just a useful technique, useful tip here. So traction applied to the pairs will often result in caudal translation of the distal fragments. So again, you may want to be using another technique, maybe combining this with percutaneous forceps to compensate for that. Another really nice technique, if you have them available, is the use of these joysticks. So these are handles that you can anchor in each fragment and then use them to manipulate those bone fragments. And then once you're happy with the reduction, the joysticks actually lock onto a connecting bar. So it's kind of like a temporary external skeletal fixator. And then you can use that connecting bar to maintain your alignment while you're placing your plate. A little bit more difficult to use if you're using nails, because obviously these will be intramedullary. So you do need to be careful where you place them if you're using an intramedullary nail as your final fixation technique. And this product is produced by Synthes. They have a threaded pin at both ends. They go through the cortices. The handle is cannulated and then threads over the top. And then the threaded pin is tensioned at the top to push the teeth of the handle against the bone. And they really do stabilize very nicely. I've never had these pull out on me while I've been using them for reduction or anything like that. So as you mentioned, we can also use these percutaneous double point reduction forceps. So small bone holding forceps inserted far from the fracture site through the proximal and distal surgical approaches. And these can be used to help align your fracture. Now, the most distal and proximal parts of the bone segment will be secured with the forceps, and then the segments are distracted and manipulated to obtain that reduction. This method, in my hands, is most successful for the radius ulna and tibia fractures, where that reduced muscle mass does allow more accurate palpation and easier reduction. It is important when you place these, remember to place the forceps so they don't interfere with your plate placement. And also remember, these are passive devices, so you are going to require an assistant to help maintain that reduction until the plate fixation is completed or until your nail is in place. So you can't have, it's not like the joysticks, they won't maintain themselves. In humerus and femur fractures, this method is often more challenging due to the large surrounding muscle mass. And certainly in these cases, intramedullary pinning may be more successful as a technique for you. Certainly we do sometimes use, as you can see in this picture, we've used a forceps right in the middle of the fracture here. So this is obviously not being used so much to manipulate the bone fragments, but it is being used to approximate a severely displaced fragment there, which was displaced caudally. And you can also use them to control those long oblique fractures in this situation too. So here's another case example here, and it just goes to show sometimes you're going to need a combination of methods to achieve this reduction. This was a case we operated quite recently, a 67 kilogram, 1-year-old Great Dane. This dog was huge. He was 67 kilograms, but he wasn't fat. He was really just very, very big. And the fracture he came in with was 24 years old, radius ulna fracture, as you can see here. Now, when you look at this, you think this doesn't look like it's going to be too bad to reduce. It should be pretty easy. We really, really struggled to reduce this, and we ended up using a combination of techniques, as you can see here. So we've got those Synthes joysticks applied in the ulna, and then we've also got a fracture distractor applied in the radius, and we have an intramedullary pin in the ulna as well. So we used all of those in order to achieve the reduction that we wanted with this guy. And we did eventually get there, but it certainly was quite a challenging one. So sometimes need to be prepared to use more than one technique to get where you want to be. But we did eventually get there. You can see rather an unconventional form of treatment here. We've used an interlocking nail in the ulna to stabilize this fracture. And that's the dog 24 hours post-surgery, weight-bearing, and he went home that day. And we can see here, and we followed him up again. So 4 weeks post-op, proliferative callus formation, and at 8 weeks post-op, again, completely healed. And this dog went on to do very, very well. So when we talk about specifically minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis, this is going to refer to the use of bone plates following certain principles. So again, we're talking about that use of indirect closed reduction techniques. We're talking about epiperiosteal plate insertion through small incisions remote to the fracture site with minimal reliance on secondary implants and bone grafts. And while soft tissue preservation is certainly prioritized over anatomic reconstruction and absolute mechanical stability and restoration of alignment, which can be a substantial challenge, as we mentioned, in minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis is critical. Restoration of adequate length and alignment is going to be absolutely paramount to a functional recovery. So it's no good getting really quick healing if the limb is not in a functional position. And contrary to minor length discrepancies, malalignment in the frontal and sagittal planes can have quite severe clinical repercussions, including osteoarthritis secondary to alteration in articular cartilage loading patterns, and can potentially increase the risk for cranial cruciate ligament rupture if we have tibial fractures, for example. So once you are happy with your alignment and your epiperiosteal plate position, you can use these push-pull devices, one per segment, to temporarily secure your plate. And this can be quite nice if you want to do this and check your alignment and your reduction using the C-arm. And then it allows you to check that alignment before you're applying your final fixation. So push-pull devices are applied through just one cortex, and they're generally applied through the locking hole position of the plate. But that is a little controversial. Some people don't use the locking position. And you can use them to ensure that the plate is flush against the bone, at least at one point in each fragment. We don't generally place these bicortical. We don't use them to manipulate the bone. So different to the joysticks get placed through both cortices, whereas the push-pull devices get placed just through one. So you can see here in these pictures that we've used one push-pull device, and we've got the depth gauge in place as well proximally. And then we've got one push-pull device again and the depth gauge in place distally. So we're obviously placing our definitive fixation here, measuring for our screws proximally and distally. But you can see that we used the push-pull devices to keep the plate against the bone. And we did check our positioning there before going ahead and placing those screws. And there's the fixation technique eventually on the post-operative radiographs. And you can see actually that's not an immediate post-op view. This fracture's already healed, so this is a follow-up view. So minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis certainly can be considered to be applicable to all long bones. It is more complex for some than others. Certainly easier to start your learning curve with minimally invasive plate application in the radius and tibia. And then when you're comfortable with those, then graduate on to the humerus and the femur following that. But it certainly is applicable to all of these situations. So in terms of clinical outcome, this has been looked at in a study by Desjardins and Guillot, and the results here are reported to an earlier study. So it wasn't a comparative study. The results here are being reported to an earlier study that was published in JAVMA by Dudley in 1997. So Guillot and Dajadan looked at 36 tibial fractures. They looked at the healing time and comparing minimally invasive to open reduction in tendonic fixation. They had 46 days for MIO and 87 days for ORIF. Now, certainly, this is not really fair to compare these two studies. I know this is not, strictly speaking, the right thing to do, as one study is substantially earlier than the others, and a lot of techniques have changed. We've certainly got better at fracture repair since then, but it gives you a little bit of an idea. So certainly in terms of complications, open reduction internal fixation, 18% were severe, and with minimally invasive surgery, just under 3% severe, and 8 to 9% minor there. Now, the severe complication in this study was a plate fracture, and this occurred in the youngest and smallest animal in the study. It was a three-month-old Sheltie that was weighing 2.7 kilograms. And in that case, they had used a 13-hole 1.520 titanium veterinary cuttable plate, and it did fracture through the screw hole that was over the fracture site 12 days postoperatively. They did manage to revised that case, again, using minimally invasive techniques. So they just removed the failed plate and then replaced with a 12-hole, 2-millimeter stainless steel limited contact dynamic compression plate. And really, technical errors probably were the cause of this complication. This just goes to show everyone has a learning curve. So they only left 2 empty screw holes at the fracture site, and that did create local stress concentration by shortening the plate working length. And additionally, the use of titanium was probably not ideal in this case. It is a more notch-sensitive material than stainless steel and therefore more susceptible to crack propagation, in part due to the proximity between its yield and ultimate tensile strengths. Minor complications in that study did include 1 intramedullary rod migration and 3 superficial wound dehiscences due to self-trauma of the wounds. So after we've achieved our indirect fracture reduction, we do need to take great care to assess really, really carefully our limb alignment and whether that's using intraoperative imaging or whether we're just using our landmarks, our palpable landmarks. Malalignment certainly is the most common complication associated with minimally invasive osteosynthesis, and say that's because that fracture site is not exposed and we can't rely on direct visualization of correct reduction in order to restore our alignment. We really do have to emphasize that a loss of length or a moderate malalignment on the sagittal plane, so procavatum or recavatum, generally does not affect the patient's functional outcome, but malalignment in the frontal plane, so varus or valgus, or in the axial plane, can severely compromise limb function. So if you notice those on your post-op radiographs, this really is something you need to go back and revise. Proper patient positioning and surgical draping are really, really important with minimally invasive surgeries in order to allow you to really evaluate that limb alignment. And I really think we probably spend almost as long positioning our patients sometimes as we do in surgery. The limb does need to be completely visible in both frontal and sagittal planes after draping, and it really does need to be possible to assess that proximal and distal joint throughout their range of motion. So really, it is really worth taking the time to make sure that you achieve all of that. And as you can see here, so really, this is what you end up with in surgery. That whole middle section, you are absolutely blind to. So it really is something that you need to be able to assess via those joints proximally and distally and via your imaging. And even positioning the patient so that you can get really nice views using the C-arm can be more of a challenge than you would anticipate. So this is a case here, certainly a case that caused us some difficulties. So this was a German short hair pointer presented to us at 7 months old with this mid-diaphyseal femoral fracture. And certainly this was a case that we thought, well, this is a really nice one to potentially try and repair minimally invasively. Now, what you can see here on these images, and look carefully at these C-arm images here, we really haven't got very good visualization of the proximal joint. So we think we can see it, but we really can't see it very well. It's very difficult to appreciate there what position that femoral head is actually in. And certainly the femoral neck and what angle that is at is very difficult to tell. So when we go out to our post-op evaluation, you can see here, certainly this is not going to be good enough. On the craniocaudal view, maybe it doesn't look too bad, other than it looks like we've got a coxa valga there. But then when we look at the lateral view, the fracture is nowhere near reduced, and there is severe antiversion there. Also, the screw looks like it's either in nothing or it's in the greater trochanter. And this can be a real problem with locking implants because they do feel like they're secure even when they're not really purchasing very much bone at all. So this is not a case of does this need revising, it's when does it need revising. And certainly we did take this case back to surgery. We did still manage to do the revision in a minimally invasive fashion. But certainly in this case, this really was our fault. With that position of the femoral head there, if we'd really been assessing the range of motion of the joints appropriately and if we'd positioned our patient appropriately so we could get good intraoperative imaging, then this would not have happened. So you can see here that at 4 weeks, this fracture is healing well. Everything's been maintained and this dog did go on to do very well, but certainly it would have been preferable to not have to do that revision surgery. Complications that we can run into, particularly with minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis here, if you're not careful in ensuring that the plate is definitively epiperiosteal, then you can compress neurovascular structures against the bone. So in the case with the humerus, thinking about the brachial artery and the median and ulnar nerves, that can be a problem. So you can see here, what you really need to do is be very careful. You can see in this video, making sure that you can feel the plate in that epiperosteal tunnel, that you really have created that tunnel in a nice fashion, and then sliding that plate along. And in this case, we then made the proximal incision over the top. So we've just sliding the plate up, and then we're going to make our proximal incision in a little bit. Now, if you are worried about compressing the neurovascular structures, then certainly our next point here is going to be to consider a minimally invasive nail osteosynthesis in that situation. Obviously, that is not going to be an issue. And certainly interlocking nailing can be used similarly to plate osteosynthesis in a minimally invasive fashion. And that has developed the acronym MINO, so minimally invasive nail osteosynthesis. You can see this is a case here that we elected to treat that way, a femoral fracture, and you can see the post-operative radiographs there, just the small staple lines indicating the approaches that were made. So here's another case here. So this is a Labrador, again, comminuted femoral fracture here, presented to us at 11 months old. And this was actually originally went to the referring veterinarian who performed this repair. Now, I think when you look at this, you kind of think, you know, there are quite a few errors with this fixation. You'd be worried about not probably if this is going to fail, but when it's likely to fail. Certainly that intramedullary pin is very short. It's very small in diameter. And certainly we've put quite a big stress riser here over those open screw holes over the fracture site there. So if we then look at what happened, so this is 2 weeks post-operatively, and certainly we have, as we would probably predict, a failure of the plate directly over that fracture site there. So this definitely needs a revision, but if we think about that fracture callus now, this fracture callus has been trying to form now for over 2 weeks. It's really going to be quite detrimental to try and remove that. So what we'd like to do is to revise this in a minimally invasive fashion. And you can see here that is what we went ahead to do. So we made our proximal and distal incisions, as you can see in the images on the left-hand side. We removed the plate through those incisions. It was fractured in the middle, so that was pretty easy. The pin was loose, so again, so removing that was pretty easy as well. And then we went ahead and placed an interlocking nail using those same incisions, really as you would attempt to do if this fracture was fresh. And you can see here, these are our post-operative views. You can see that certainly there is quite a lot of the bone fragments have kind of, they're certainly relatively displaced. But because we've done a minimally invasive approach, we're not too worried about that. We actually look at the term adjacency rather than a kind of how well these things are reduced. And adjacency is considered to be acceptable in these cases if the little cloud of bone fragments is within two diameters of the bone, its bone width itself. So you can see that certainly is the case here. We would not be worried about whether this is going to go on and heal. And certainly, if we look here at 3 weeks postoperatively, the fracture site is active, going on to heal pretty nicely there. So then looking at our minimally invasive nail osteosynthesis cases, we've certainly updated this since we now have 100 cases of this, but the results are really very similar in terms of the percentages. When we were looking at 60 cases, 7% of them were in the humerus, 66% in the femur, and 27% of these were in the tibia. The healing time was an average of 43 days, ranging from 21 to 65. All dogs had excellent function. And this is compared to a healing time in the literature, if we look at using the standard nail in an open fashion, of about 112 days. Now, definitely, there are two differences here, obviously. So again, not really a fair comparison because we're using an angle stable nail, which doesn't have the slack associated with the standard nails. So that's probably at least part of the reason why these are healing quicker. But maybe a part is also the minimally invasive approach. The average, as we looked at earlier with the plate, is 87 days. So we're substantially below that. Complications with nailing minimally invasively, 13%. They were all minor complications, including seroma formation and soft tissue swelling at the level of the distal bolts. That was most commonly in the tibia. And it is really important if you're using the nail in the tibia to make sure that you trim those bolts really nice and short. Otherwise, you do get these complications. One case did develop an osteomyelitis, which resolved with use of broad-spectrum antibiotics, and one did have an implant infection, which required implant removal, and one had persistent lameness and some bolt failure and ended up having the implant removed. So you can see here, this is the kind of result that we can expect with a femur fracture and a tibia fracture there, both showing nice organized remodeling of the cortices, so long-term follow-up of those cases. So when we think about the use of bone grafting, we did say that when we're using a minimally invasive technique, we've moved away from using a lot of bone grafting. But when we're using minimally invasive techniques to address revision surgeries, then certainly bone grafting can become really useful. And an example of is this case here, which was a hypervascular non-union. Now, this had been initially repaired using a stacked pinning technique, so two intramedullary pins, no supplementary fixation. And this dog was severely lame, still non-weight-bearing lame, 4 months after this procedure, and still had severe fracture site instability. So say normally we wouldn't really ream for interlocking nails, but in this case we did ream this fracture out in order to open up the medullary canal to encourage revascularization. And this did actually produce basically a load of bone graft from the medullary canal that ended up at the fracture site. So we ended up kind of inadvertently bone grafting this, if you like. But options for this revision, if you see them here, your options would be maybe an open reduction internal fixation with bone graft and a plate. You may have quite a lot of issues with that in terms of contouring your plate. So contouring plate around callus formation can be really quite tricky. And certainly achieving compression at that fracture site at this stage is going to be pretty difficult as well. This dog had a huge amount of muscle atrophy. There was some mild osteopenia, as you can see on the radiographs too. This would be the dog's third surgery because he's already had an implant removal as well. So certainly we're concerned about the degree of morbidity for this patient, wanting to reduce that. And that really did make a minimally invasive surgery with a nail technique really quite attractive. And the fact that we got this kind of inadvertent bone graft formation from reaming out the medullary canal, just another advantage there. So you can see here, this is the same case. So we're reaming out the medullary canal there with a large drill bit. So you can see the bone graft kind of being collected as well. We did collect some additional bone graft in this case using a Michel's Trephine. And then we did place that percutaneously using fluoroscopy so that we could ensure we were placing it at the appropriate site there. And you can see here, here is our post-operative radiographs. You can see the bone graft sitting in close proximity to the fracture site, outlined in yellow just there, and satisfactory alignment there achieved as well. And then if we follow this case up, this is at 3 months post-operatively, you can see healing nicely. So definitely seeing that the minimally invasive nailing techniques and minimally invasive plating techniques can be really useful for these revision surgeries, trying to minimize the morbidity for these patients. So this dog, after being non-ambulatory for 4 months, was ambulatory immediately after surgery, so the day after surgery as well. So just see the effect of just achieving appropriate stability for this patient. This is the same patient 4 years postoperatively. For some reason, he suddenly developed a seroma cranially over the limb. I think you can probably appreciate that on the radiographs. There wasn't any infection. We did culture this. Nothing came back. But in this situation, we presumed this must be at least in some degree due to the implants. And we did go ahead and remove that implant. You can see there the seroma resolved. And we haven't seen the dog since about 4 weeks post that procedure. I presume still doing well. So moving on then to the use of minimally invasive osteosynthesis for non-diaphyseal fractures, this would be slightly more complex. And in these situations, imaging is absolutely key. So the goals of your preoperative imaging are going to include identifying the nature and location and extent of the fracture. You want to be able to determine your ideal mode of fixation. And obviously, you want to also allow templating and pre-selecting of your surgical implants here. So your preoperative imaging is going to begin with the acquisition and interpretation of high quality preoperative orthogonal radiographs of the affected segment, plus in some cases, maybe additional projections such as oblique or stress views to obviate more subtle lesions. Imaging of the contralateral segment, definitely highly recommended in minimally invasive surgery, as it is used to optimize preoperative implant selection, to compare with the fractured segment to identify normal versus abnormal structures, and so that you can accurately evaluate your postoperative alignment that you've achieved as well. Now, the main limitation associated with standard radiography is the inability to reproduce that 3D configuration of the structures examined. And advanced imaging is indicated in cases with comminuted fractures, particularly if they involve the periarticular or articular regions, and also in the assessment of complex structures such as the sacroiliac region in the pelvis. So here you can see we had a Salter-Harris fracture of the proximal humerus, but it was difficult on radiographs to interpret the exact configuration of that fracture and whether the greater tubercle was involved or not. And so we did go ahead and do the CT, and you can see on CT it becomes very clear that we do have involvement of both the humeral head and the greater tubercle, and that's going to affect our decision making for that case. I forgot to advance the image there, sorry. So you can see here, certainly, that we do have that. This arrow is not working for me. Okay, well, hopefully you can appreciate that we do have involvement of the humeral head in this situation, and then the greater tubercle here as well. So here we have a continuous picture of the fracture configuration. This is a video that that rotates in 3D. And you can see here, this can be a really nice thing to have up in surgery. If you're struggling to find landmarks, if you're struggling to interpret what's going on in surgery, then certainly having this rotating in front of you at a relatively slow speed can be super helpful in helping you find maybe a landmark that you can particularly palpate to help you achieve that reduction. So I do quite frequently have one of these rotating for me in surgery. It avoids having to have an assistant come in and rotate the image for you while you're operating. So a CT scan is best suited in such cases and does produce these two-dimensional transverse images and also a 3D reconstruction of the affected bones. Transverse images are used for the precise assessment of any fissure lines, which are absolutely essential in optimizing implant placement, particularly if you have periarticular fractures. And coronal and parasagittal images are going to provide invaluable information in cases of sacroiliac laxation with associated sacral fractures, for example. Now, the use of 3D imaging helps in understanding such complex intraarticular fractures and definitely does improve your preoperative planning. And it can also be beneficial in evaluating fragment distribution and can be used to guide reduction maneuvers. So as you can see here, this is an interesting case to start the video here. So this is a case, it's actually one of our technicians in the hospital who slipped and fell. And if you look at the radiographs on both views here, you really struggle to see. It doesn't look like that fissure line extends into the articular margin there. So this would have been treated very differently had a CT scan not been performed. And you see, as soon as we get the CT scan, you can appreciate those intraarticular fissures definitely do propagate down into the joint. And this is now very definitively a case that needs surgical reconstruction and stabilization. So a human case, but certainly the same principles do apply for us in veterinary medicine. We do often see something more on CT that we did not appreciate on our plain radiographs. Now, obviously, the main shortcoming associated with CT is going to be cost. However, because of the benefits of accurate planning and the subsequent avoidance of intraoperative complications that can be overcome, then CT is, in my opinion, should be considered an important part of preoperative planning. If you have, if you're considering using MIO, so you're not going to be able to appreciate those fissures intraoperatively, and if you're planning on using a surgical technique here. Now, this is another example here. You can see this is actually, again, in a human case. This is a stress fracture of the calcaneus, which was causing acute heel pain. And the cause of it was not discerned on radiographs. It was not discerned on CT either. And actually, this person went back and back and back for multiple imaging. It was presumed to be a really persistent case of bursitis until an MRI was performed. And you can see here, then you can very easily appreciate this stress fracture of the calcaneus on MRI. So certainly, again, even if you don't use those advanced images in the first instance, if a case is not progressing as you would expect, maybe a good idea then to get some advanced imaging in the future. So as we've already mentioned, the most obvious limitation of minimally invasive surgery is that inability to assess our reduction status during surgery, secondary to the lack of fracture site visualization. And intraoperative fluoroscopy can be very, very helpful in assisting with reduction maneuvers and assessing our alignment. When we're using bridging osteosynthesis, where the longest implant is selected, extending from joint to joint, or in young dogs from physis to physis, as well as in the treatment of articular and juxta-articular fractures, accurate intraoperative imaging is also really useful to ascertain that our screws or locking bolts are not violating essential structures like the articular surface, the spinal canal, or the intervertebral disc spaces, for example. And this that you can see here is the motorized Siemens C-arm, which allows you to use fluoroscopy like a CT scanner. So it gets views in multiple orientations, including transverse slices. And this, the use of this can be seen here. So if you look at this image here, this is obviously just your straight view. And it looks here like, yes, your screw might be very close to the articular surface, but it really isn't in it. And then if we look at some different images here, using that Siemens C-arm, you can appreciate that screw is certainly intra-articular. So certainly a very, very useful toy. I wish I had one. I don't. I have lots of toys here, but this is not one of the ones I have yet. But certainly you can just see, even if you're using the images that we have in terms of 2D imaging in surgery, yeah, you can still be surprised, unfortunately. So we mentioned some indirect reduction techniques for long bones, but we didn't really talk much about ligament ataxis, which is a super useful technique for articular fractures. So in this case, you can use the fact that the collateral ligaments are intact to help you reduce that fracture. So with these pretty typical Salter-Harris type 2 fractures of the proximal tibia here, you can adduct the limb. And what that does is it causes the lateral collateral ligament to stretch and fatigue. And then with a very small amount of pressure from your thumb on the medial side at the same time, you can bring this fracture back into abduction. And then the fracture will go on and indirectly reduce, as you can see here. And then you can use those percutaneous point-to-point reduction forceps that we discussed earlier to maintain that reduction while you place your implant. So these are actually quite nice periarticular fractures to start with if you're going to start doing these minimally invasively. Other reduction techniques for our periarticular and articular fractures, certainly these custom clamps are really quite nice if you're going to treat the Salter-Harris 4 condylar fractures, the humeral fractures, in a minimally invasive fashion. Certainly that's been reported in a couple of papers in the literature and is one that, again, a lot of people start with. So they are two radiolucent plates that are connected by clamps, and they can be used, as I say, to reduce those humeral condylar fractures pretty nicely. Another technique which is commonly spoken about is the push-pull techniques using intramedullary pins, as you can see in the images here. So you have IM pins on Jacob's chucks. So they're kind of like the joysticks that we talked about earlier from Synthes, but quite a lot cheaper, and most people will have these on the shelf. And you can use those in both the ileal wing there and in the ischial tuberosity, or potentially you can use bone reduction forceps on the ischial tuberosity through a small incision. And you can use those then to reduce those sacroiliac luxations for a minimally invasive repair. And when we think about our fixation for these articular and periarticular fractures, most likely we're going to be using combinations of bone screws. Some people do like the use of cannulated bone screws, and we do have a case example of that in a little bit. Certainly quite a lot of KY use for those Salter-Harris fractures, as you can see here, being used for a proximal tibial fracture and for a proximal humeral fracture as well. And potentially the use of orthopedic wire, not so much in cyclage fashion, but normally as a tension band wire for some of these cases as well. So as you said, for minimally invasive articular fractures, they have been published in the literature. Probably the study that most people are familiar with is one by Jimmy Cook and others, which looked at 11 humeral condylar fractures. They achieved anatomical reduction, they thought, in six of these, and in the other five, they had less than a 1.5 millimeter step. All of them went on to heal very well, and they all gained 90 to 100% of normal function. So now if we compare that to what we've been used to for some of these articular fractures, certainly a limited approach does have advantages. Disadvantages, as we've already discussed, you are going to have poorer visualization, but you are going to reduce that soft tissue damage. The osteotomy techniques that a lot of people used to use, those transolecranon osteotomy, certainly they give you great visualization. You can see absolutely everything. However, just the osteotomy itself has a 37% risk of complications. So this is not something personally that I use at all. I have never actually used it. I have seen colleagues use it, and I always kind of really quite envious of the visualization of the joint surface they get, but I'm not envious of the complications that come afterwards. And certainly these osteotomies and the complication rate that's associated with them has produced this trend toward minimally invasive treatment of articular fractures. And certainly that is supported by the positive results from Cook's study and from others who have reported similar numbers. Certainly something that is, say, when we do recommend use of fluoroscopy when we're treating these articular fractures. And some people have also reported doing these with arthroscopy to assist with their reduction as well. So assessing their reduction at the articular surface itself. For me, I'm more of a fluoroscopy fan, but certainly some people are using arthroscopy to assess that very satisfactorily. So this is a case here. Again, if you want to start doing things minimally invasive, this is a bit of a cheat, they're very easy to do minimally invasively, is your incomplete ossification of the humeral condyle cases. So this is Beau, she's a 7-month-old Springer Spaniel, and she presented with bilateral incomplete ossification and associated lameness on both sides. And in this case, we did repair both of these minimally invasively. So just a stab incision that's stretched open with artery forceps there, an initial K wire placed across the fissure, alignment checked using the C-arm, and then a cannulated AccuTrack screw, which is a self-compressing tapered cannulated headless titanium screw, which can be placed over the K wire to achieve your stabilization. Certainly, cannulated screws do facilitate minimally invasive surgery, but we do need to be careful considering mechanical considerations here. There's not a lot of studies out there showing whether they are mechanically equal to their non-cannulated counterparts. So do be careful with the implants that you're using. And certainly, this case did very, very well for the time that I followed her up, which was about 4 years. But there would be a concern here, is this dog going to fracture the screw long term? Because as we all know, this fissure is unlikely to heal. So, you know, it's a nice technique, it's a simple technique, but we do need to warn owners that there could be a risk of screw failure. So as we talked about right at the beginning, minimally invasive articular fractures, we do need to make sure that we still adhere to all of those principles of articular fracture repair. We do need to get into them early wherever possible. We do need to achieve anatomical reduction. We do need to compress the fragments, and we do need to achieve restoration of the anatomical axis, and also ideally get them into physical rehabilitation as soon as possible. Now, certainly decision making is going to be affected by what comes in through your door. So if you see a case like the one we saw right at the top, which was a 2-week old fracture, it's really quite substantially displaced, then we're going to be much more likely to consider open reduction internal fixation for that case. when you compare that to the case below, which was only 24 hours old and very minimally displaced. So in this case, minimally invasive osteosynthesis would be very attractive. So here's a case here. This was a 5-month-old mixed breed dog who presented having jumped off a deck 24 hours previously, did have this Salter Harris 4 lateral humeral condylar fracture that I'm sure everyone has seen many of. And it's minimally displaced here. And we could feel just with the dog under sedation and under anesthesia that we could manually reduce this fracture. You could feel it was mobile and you could feel that you could reduce it. So certainly assessing that before you go into surgery can be really useful to know, is this going to go well for me or not if I try this minimally invasively? If you can't move it, then probably you want to try and do this open. So you can see here we did use the condylar clamp to maintain our reduction, and certainly that's gone pretty nicely. And then we can use the C-arm to check that our reduction is then appropriate. We can then place our pilot K-wire across the condyle to make sure that's in the appropriate position, check that in both planes. We can then use a drill and a tap to then to drill for our screw. In this case, we used a position screw because this was a young puppy with soft bone. And you can see here, then we've placed our screw and we're in the middle of placing our K wire up the epicondylar ridge as well. So one thing to bear in mind here is that you don't really want to be too accurate with your initial K-wire placement unless you're going to use a cannulated screw. If you put your K-wire exactly where you want your screw to be, then you're going to have to drill next to it, which is super annoying, or get a cannulated drill bit out. You certainly remember you can still use a cannulated drill bit to drill over the K-wire and then place a normal screw. So when I do place that K-wire in the perfect position inadvertently, that's often what I will do. I will use the cannulated drill bit and then I know I'm going to get my screw in the right position so I can remove my K wire and then place my screw. So here's our intra-op fluoroscopy images and then post-op radiographs. And you can see here really just two staples there being the size of the approach and a really nice technique. Transcondylar screw maybe a little more angled than we would ideally like, but certainly pretty happy with that. And that went on to heal very well. Other periarticular fractures which can be really tempting to use minimally invasive surgery for are these minimally invasive femoral neck fractures, plus minus the Salter Harris fractures here. So this is a slipped capital femoral epiphysis that we've seen. Minimally invasive osteosynthesis certainly can be used for both the slipped capital femoral epiphyses and the femoral neck fractures. Most of us, if we've treated enough of these, will have seen those cases of apple coring on our post-op assessment, as you can see here. So this is an 8-week assessment, and certainly there is quite dramatic apple coring at the fracture site. And there's a lot of debate as to exactly what causes this. Is it a combination of devascularization from our open approach? Is it potentially that we're over-stabilizing these maybe? Is it a bit of both? Do we really know? But it's not always clinically significant, but if it was clinically significant, you would have to remove the implants, and certainly you'd be pretty concerned about removing implants in this case, that you might end up with a very unstable situation. So if there is a contribution from devascularization, then minimally invasive surgeries here again become quite attractive. So this was a little dog called Stout, 12-week-old Labrador. She'd been hit by a car, and she had a right comminuted femoral neck fracture, which I think is very easy to appreciate, but she also had a left slipped capital femoral epiphysis. Now, when you look at this, in the radiographs, I was strongly suspicious that it was a slipped epiphysis. She had some pain on that hip side as well, which was certainly a bit of a giveaway, but I did go ahead and perform, as we mentioned, CT can be super helpful. We did perform a CT here, and I think you can appreciate on the CT a little bit better that certainly there is this kind of slight step at the physis just here. So it's minimally displaced, but it is there. And if I ask her to take all of the weight on that side, you'd be worried that it would become more displaced. So maybe we need to do something about both of these injuries. So in this case, we did go ahead and perform a percutaneous reduction and fixation bilaterally. Now, in that very first picture there, I'm cheating. That's not Stout. All of the other pictures are. Certainly what you can see in that very first picture, which is nice, is that blood in the hub of the needle is pretty much the blood loss you get from this procedure. So it can be a really nice bloodless procedure. The second picture here, I say, is Stout. And what you can appreciate here, I think, is when you want to perform this technique, how far distally you have to start those pins tablets, because remember, you have to traverse all of the thick soft tissue of the femur before you're even going to hit that lateral cortex, and then you've still got to angle them appropriately up and through that femoral neck. So if you see on this picture, there's a marker with a skin marker here, and this is where most people will try and start their pins. They'll try and start them too proximally, and then you'll never be able to achieve the angle. You do need to start them right the way down here. So this is my normal trick. I ask the resident to say where would they start with their pins, and this is generally where they point out to me. So you do need to go far more distal than you think. These are 0.9 millimeter K wires. Certainly for this procedure, I would say intraoperative fluoroscopy is essential in my hands. I would not be able to do this without. I use it multiple times to guide that my pins are going in the correct position in both planes. So again, patient positioning here, very, very important. What's really nice about this procedure, this is basically the kit you need. So your technicians will absolutely love you. Your nurses will love getting ready for this procedure, other than the C-arm part, I guess. Certainly this is stout immediately post-operatively. So you can see that the comminuted femoral neck fracture, certainly we've got, it's reasonable reduction. It's not perfect. The slipped capital femoral epiphysis is pretty good, but you'd expect that because it wasn't really displaced before we started. But certainly what's nice is we haven't caused a lot of soft tissue damage here. Now, the pins are deliberately left really long. There's no point doing a minimally invasive implant placement if you need to do a maximally invasive pin removal later, and we do plan on removing these as soon as things have healed. So then if we look at our post-op films here, so this is 2 weeks post-op, you can see certainly we have progressive healing. Everything's looking really quite nice. It does look a little bit like some of those pins have backed out, but that's actually just because the femoral head is growing, which is a positive sign. We have continued growth. And if we look here, this is a video of the dog 2 weeks postoperatively. Now, typically, this dog was not leash trained, so walking this dog was a substantial challenge. This is about the 10th video we took, and it's about the best we were going to get. But I think you can see, considering we've had, you know, surgery on both sides, this dog's actually walking pretty well. And when she comes towards us, you can see that really she's only minimally lame on those pelvic limbs now. So really quite a good result. We can then see as we go forward, this is radiographs of stout at 4 weeks postoperatively. You can see really nice satisfactory healing of both of those fracture sites. And we did go ahead and remove those implants. We would have removed them at 4 weeks post-op, but the owner wasn't ready to stay for that procedure that day. So that's why they were removed then at 5 weeks postoperatively. And you can see radiographs post-implant removal there. And they were just removed through little stab incisions to pull the pins out. And there's stout following implant removal. She went home and she did absolutely great following that procedure. So as we mentioned earlier, advanced imaging can be really useful if you've got decisions to make regarding complex structures such as the sacroiliac region in the pelvis. Now, this is a 3D reconstruction of two different dogs, both with sacral fractures. In the first case, you can see there is a comminuted fracture of the sacral body and the left wing. Now, if you see a lesion like this, this does preclude fixation using a compression screw. So this is going to be a case that gets treated conservatively in order to prevent iatrogenic neurological damage, at least in my hands. Conversely, if you see a case like the one on the right with that simple parasagittal fracture, then this certainly can be treated surgically using minimally invasive techniques, and then there'll be very little risk of any iatrogenic trauma. And I think these are super nice to treat minimally invasively because when you have a relatively simple sacroiliac luxation, we all know the landmarks we can use to make sure that they're reduced appropriately. But these parasagittal fractures can be a little more difficult to make sure that you achieve good reduction, and the approach is pretty aggressive. So here's an example here. This is a 5-year-old mastiff that was hit by a car, and he presented with a non-weight-bearing lameness of the left hind limb. He also had some lumbar sacral pain, and the pain did increase with hip range of motion. And on the radiographs here, I think you can see that there is a step at that sacroiliac junction, so you can be very worried there about some sacral pathology. So that prompted us to go ahead and perform a CT scan. And certainly we can see here, this is the case that you saw in that initial image, that parasagittal fracture there. This dog is going to have a much easier time of recovery if we can go in and repair that. Now, if we look at the approaches that we have here to a sacroiliac fracture or luxation or a sacral fracture, both being the same, they are pretty invasive. So whether you use a dorsal approach or the less commonly performed ventral approach, both of them are going to involve complete stripping of the musculature and the inherent stability that that does provide. So if we can avoid that, these dogs are likely to have an easier time. The problems with the open approach, again, is that although the landmarks for screw placement have been described pretty well for sacral fractures, you often cannot see these landmarks. They're often distorted, and this can lead to incorrect implant placement, such as in this case. Certainly, you'd be worried about where that screw's going on the lateral view. And certainly, you can also end up with some fairly poor fracture reduction in some cases as well. So a minimally invasive approach can be a really nice way to go. Now, this looks very, very busy in this picture, and this is a case where we did use two C-arms. Nice if you have them. Most people don't, and it definitely isn't necessary. The reason this is nice is you can get those orthogonal views throughout the surgery, but say it really isn't necessary, and we normally just use the one that's going from top to bottom. The side-to-side one is something that we do not commonly set up for. So this minimally invasive approach has been described by Tonks in 2008, where the mean screw depth and sacral width ratio on immediate post-op and re-examination radiographs was 64% and 61% respectively. The mean percentage reduction of the sacroiliac joint on immediate post-op and re-examined radiographs was 91% and 87% respectively. So you can see pretty good results there. And this study did show that successful repair of sacroiliac fracture reductions determined by radiographic assessment can be achieved by fluoroscopically guided closed reduction and percutaneous screw fixation in lag fashion. Now, we do some fairly fancy things here now, but certainly most people do not have all of the equipment that we have in terms of the tables and the imaging. So this is a technique that we initially put together for repair of these fractures, and it really doesn't involve having a lot of specialist equipment at all. So I think this is the one that's probably best to discuss. So the first views that you're going to take in surgery, first thing is make sure the dog is very, very well positioned. We've gone through this a few times now, but making sure you want superimposition of the spinous processes on this view. So your lateral transverse processes do need to be completely superimposed so that you know the dog is nice and straight on the table. Then you can use this really nice long needle here placed over the sacrum to make sure you get the correct position. And this can require several attempts, particularly if this is a very well-muscled dog or if it's a dog that's had severe trauma and is very swollen, because often the landmarks can be pretty difficult to feel. But you can place this needle, or if you think it's going to take you several attempts to place a needle, what can be nice is just using a little washer that we normally use around the screws. Use the washer on the skin, get the washer into the right position, and then place the needle through, and then you don't have to keep stabbing the dog through all of the soft tissues. So that's a nice little technique too. So once you're using your needle, try and get the needle as parallel as possible to your x-ray beam. Then you can remove the needle and replace that with a K-wire, or place a K-wire directly next to the needle before you remove it. And you can use this for temporary fixation of your sacroiliac luxation if you want to. You can also use those Jacob's chucks and intramedullary pins that we saw earlier to get your reduction achieved. Then you can place a little portal over your K-wire and then use a switching stick technique to replace your K-wire with a drill. You're going to drill your pilot hole first and then your glide hole, all using this switching stick technique. And then increase your incision size very slightly. You can't really use a depth gauge here because the depth gauge will not fit through the incision that we've made. So the length of the screw is going to be determined based on your preoperative planning to make sure you get more than that 60% across the sacral body. The tap certainly is very aggressive and can chew up soft tissues. So if it's possible, what I like to do is, when I'm using this technique, is replace your portal with a 5mm syringe, which has been cut down. So remove the tip, place the syringe through your incision, and that's big enough to allow the tap and then the screw and the washer to be placed through it, and it will also protect your soft tissues there as well. So here you can see that we are then drilling our pilot hole through our portal, and here's that use of that syringe case that you can see, and we've got our switching stick technique still going on through there, but really nice little technique there with the cutting the tip off of the thing to save your soft tissues. Here you can see your tap is being placed through that syringe, and then you can go ahead and place your screw and washer through that same syringe case. Once your screw is then tightened down, you can then go ahead and remove your syringe, and you will be done. So that's the approach that you end up making there. You can see just two little staples to close the approach. So very different to the big dorsal and ventral approaches that we can see. And you can also see on the lateral view here, very nice accurate implant placement as well. So this is a post-op CT. We do not charge the owners for these. These are done just for us to evaluate our results. They were used to write a paper as well. So here you can see transverse and sagittal views here on the CT showing correct implant placement there in both views. Here is an image which was used for the published study by Desjardins and Marcharello, presented in ECVS in 2015. And you can see here that the imaging was assessed in both the dorsal plane, sagittal plane, and transverse plane to look at implant placement and assess how accurate we had been. And then if we look at some of the images here, so when we were evaluating the craniocaudal screw angle in the transverse plane, you can see the hugely increased angulation and also the increased standard deviation of the screw placement that was achieved in the open reduction internal fixation category. And this was performed by a very experienced surgeon, actually. So certainly someone who has a lot of experience with open reduction. So we can only anticipate if this was a less experienced surgeon, these results would probably be even more dramatic. Then if we look at our results when we're looking at the dorso-ventral screw angle, again, certainly much more variation for the open reduction internal fixation cases than for the minimally invasive cases. And again, then if we did also look at how many of the screws stayed within the sacral body and how many attempts at screw placement were required in order to achieve that end result. And I think these results really speak for themselves here. As you can see, with the MIO technique, 100% of these screws remained within the sacrum, whereas with the open reduction internal fixation, 30% of them were in the S1 end plate. And again, if we look at how many trials were required for the minimally invasive technique, 100% of them achieved within a single trial, and open reduction, 30% of them did require two attempts. So just in conclusion, I think we've looked at the evolution of AO principles and how we've got to where we are today. Certainly there has been a fairly dramatic paradigm shift away from considering mostly the mechanics of fracture fixation in the 1970s, much more to considering the biology from the 1990s onwards. Certainly we have a whole host of new techniques available to us now, minimally invasive osteosynthesis in general, minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis, and if you are someone who uses the nail, then we also have minimally invasive nail osteosynthesis available to us as well. We do have a lot of new locking implants, both for the locking compression plates and the angle stable interlocking nails. Obviously, there's a huge variety of locking plates out there on the market. And certainly these can be useful when we're using our bridging osteosynthesis techniques in these minimally invasively operated patients. But it is important to remember that we do have the same ultimate goals when it comes to treating these patients. What we want to do is enhance bone healing and to promote a full and functional recovery. And certainly, as we've mentioned multiple times, minimally invasive osteosynthesis is not the ultimate goal. More important, make sure we get these results for our patients. And at that stage, I can take any questions. Oh, I see there was one and I completely ignored it. Sorry, Kat, I didn't answer you during this thing. So there was a question from Kat. Do I usually use locking plates for this technique on the diaphysis? And that there would be a concern maybe about using the standard dynamic compression plate if you only had a few screws at the top and the bottom. Certainly, I think a lot of these times I will use locking plates. Now, if you try and look at what the evidence for that is, there really isn't a lot of evidence to say that we should or shouldn't be. But I think that's largely because a lot of people in the facilities that have locking plate facilities are just choosing to use them. The dynamic compression plate, I agree, I would have some concerns about that, certainly because the screw holes are quite dramatic weak points in those plates. Limited contact dynamic compression plates, I would probably have less of a concern about. But the main thing, I think, is making sure that we don't leave just one or two screw holes empty over the fracture site. The main thing is really to commit to this being a bridging fixation technique and make sure that you're only using a couple of screws proximally and distally. The problems that we see tend to be when people get a little bit nervous, and instead of placing just two screws proximally and distally, they decide to place another one, then maybe another one, and then they only leave one or two screw holes open over the fracture site, and that definitely does create a very high strain environment there and puts a lot of stress on that implant, which will make that far more likely to fail. But yes, I do tend to use locking plates, certainly if I'm concerned about the bone quality in young patients. Almost exclusively I use the locking plates because I do like the increased bone holding, not having to worry about the screw loosening so much in the in those younger patients. Or if for some reason I cannot use a locking plate, I try and basically achieve almost like a locking construct by using a non-locking construct. So if you're using a non-locking plate, if you make sure that the two screws that you're placing are angled away from each other in both planes, and then you almost create a bit of a locking construct proximally and distally, and then you don't have to worry so much about that screw loosening before the fracture is going to heal.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Karen for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.